This is Everything is Workable, a podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm in conversation with other people about their approach to life and practice. Today's episode is with Michelle Puckett, a queer feminist lay leader at First Congregational Church in Oakland with a Buddhist mindfulness and earth-based spirituality practice, and a follower of the Radical Jesus. She shares with us the importance of embodying love as an activist, and how self-care is about care for a wider community and an essential element to enact the radical change we need to see if we're going to save life on this planet. If you enjoy this episode, please share it and visit CaitlinSCHatch.com to leave a tip to help fund the production of the show. And now, onto my conversation with Michelle. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah, of course.
Really, really appreciate it. And to begin, I like to have guests to share their personal practice and their approach to life. And I guess to start off, you sent me a lovely description, right? You describe yourself as a queer feminist lay leader at First Congregational Church in Oakland with a Buddhist mindful and earth-based spiritual practice and a follower of the Radical Jesus, which quite frankly sounds amazing. I'm like giving you a virtual fist bump. That sounds great. But could you just give like a quick rundown of what that means and looks like for you?
Yeah, I'm really honored that you asked me to be on your podcast, which I love as well. And I love what you're trying to do with the concept of everything is workable as well. So I'll just say that that seems pretty central to all the pieces that you just named for me. I am a person who did not grow up very religiously, who grew up in Dallas, Texas, around more mainstream conservative Christianity. That was what most of the people in my community were into. But my mom was always a seeker, and she was a meditator, and she found a guru when I was about 12 years old, Paramahansa Yogananda of Self-Realization Fellowship. So I got introduced to a wider lens on what spirituality can mean pretty young, and kind of grew up not as a devotee like my mom was of Self-Realization Fellowship, but very much believing in reincarnation and some of the concepts around karma and how cause and effect works, as well as delusion and that sort of thing. And kind of time went on in my life, and I didn't really select any particular path for myself spiritually, although I kind of wanted that because I could see what it did for people. I could see how it deepened their lives and gave them more power and more connection to their source. And so I kind of always wanted that, and just wound up deciding to go away to college. And I got lucky enough and found Naropa University, which is a small Buddhist inspired liberal arts college in Boulder, Colorado. And I'm a writer, and they have a really great poetry program. So I went there for that. But in the process, learned a whole lot more about Buddhism, which really hit home a lot more for me than anything I'd encountered before. And also proceeded to meet a lot of really other interesting people with on different spiritual journeys, including, you know, a friend of mine who is a priest in the Yoruban Ifa tradition and a hoodoo root worker, and got more in touch with what I had always known for myself as a woman on this physical earth, that I was that I cared very much about the connection to my body and to the physical earth. And that was always a struggle I had with my mom, where she would talk about the idea of, you know, non-attachment and that sort of thing. But she had a read on it that was very obviously influenced by her by the culture she grew up in you know, white conservative Christian culture, and so it was very, you know, kind of bypassing the body and the earth. And I never liked that. And I would say to her, "But I don't want to stop my friends, and I don't want to stop liking food." And it was kind of a funny, like, ongoing thing we had.
So, like, sort of moving away from seeing the body as sinful as a basis for sin.
Yeah. And that's not a term that she used, but it came through in terms of, you know, kind of the judgments that I could perceive in why one would want to bypass the body, you know. And then I found in, you know, like Thich Nhat Hanh as a teacher, just the body as a path and very much through more earth-based spirituality. And so I started practicing a lot more of that with my friends there who were already actively engaged in that. And then I moved out to the Bay Area afterwards to Oakland, California, to go to Mills College to continue on with my poetry and get an MFA. And I wound up falling in with this incredible community of radical Christians who know a very different Jesus than one that I learned about in Texas. So totally blindsided me. I would have never expected growing up that I would be someone who goes to church every week and was super involved. But basically, I started dating a guy who was a liberation theology pastor, and he introduced me to this whole group of people who saw Jesus as the founder of their movement, and these were people who were out in the streets with us all the time and who were protesting and making community and sticking up for the most dispossessed people in society and doing what I always thought Jesus was supposed to have done. So my ears perked up, and basically he and I broke up, and I continued on with First Congregational Church of Oakland, which was just down the street from his church. And we had known a bunch of the people there, and I'm bisexual. Many, many of the people who lead that church are queer women. And they were just, they scooped me up and they helped me get through that whole process of a big life change and changing partnership and all that. And I've been with them ever since. They've become one of my major spiritual homes.
Yeah. I really, really like Radical Jesus, obviously. I already said that. and I think it's because Jesus was radical. Jesus was totally radical. And I don't think that people necessarily appreciate that, especially growing up in the culture that we have largely in the West, where it's sort of like you get, I guess you get like Christianity light influencing everything. Mm-hmm. And you don't necessarily understand the impact. I recently heard this really beautiful story. It was on This American Life, I think, and it was a father relaying a conversation he had with his daughter, who was like four, and how he'd explained, she found something about Jesus, and she's like, who's Jesus? So he explained who Jesus was, and she thought Jesus was great. She's like, well, Jesus is the man, you know? So she was really into Jesus. She really loved the loving thing. That was her big deal. She's like, he loves everyone. Jesus, he's all about the love. And she was really big on the love. Yeah. And then she, you know, time goes by and she's in school. She's like five now. And she gets the day off because it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And she sees a picture of Martin Luther King somewhere. Oh, yes. And this is the other thing is like, eventually she reaches, like Easter comes and she's like, what's with Easter? Why is Jesus on the cross? What's going on? And he talks about how he explained to her, well, at the time, there were some people who didn't like what Jesus was saying. Yeah. And they didn't like it so much that they killed him. Yeah. And so she's like, oh, that's really sad. Because he was big on love. And it's like, well, yeah. And so he talks about then she sees this picture of Martin Luther King on the cover of something. And she's like, who's that? And he's like, oh, well, he's the reason why you have the day off today. It's a special day celebrating him. He's a very important person. And he was a preacher. And she's like, oh, like Jesus? And he goes, yeah, like Jesus. And she's like, did he preach about love? He's like, well, yeah, actually, he did. And then she says, did they kill him too? Mm-hmm. The father's talking, like, he tells the story, like, this was a profound, like, oh my goodness, the wisdom from this child's voice, like, I'd never thought of that before. Mm. And I was listening to it going, well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I would love is if you could talk a bit about love.
Mm-hmm.
And radical Jesus and love and what that means to you.
Again, I'm shocked every day. I sat down to meditate and pray this morning, and I'm shocked every day how much Jesus has come to mean to me, actually. But it's not surprising when you look at it through those child's eyes, like this little girl you're talking about. Just seems like a no-brainer in terms of that concept of just loving everyone and that radical humanity there, to take that stance and to. I love that the idea that it was good that Jesus was made flesh, and that it was good that he was human, and it was good that we were all human, and it was good that we should be loved and that we should love one another. And I think it's part of my spiritual practice as well as my political orientation in the world to understand that empire always has been, and always will be what stands in the way of love, of one another and of self, of the earth, of our bodies, of embodiment. And that was the central theme of Jesus's life, was to resist and to push up against, an empire that tried to name itself and its particular, use of power in terms of force as the most powerful thing in the world. And he knew that that wasn't the case. And he expressed power in a very different way. And I think any Jesus that is not being presented in a radical way is just a really immature understanding of who that man was and what he did and all the things that he preached about.
There always seems to be that tension between what is defined as powerful. And like for me, I just chalk it up to a patriarchal society, really. That aggression is seen as strong and love is seen as weak. In the interview that I did with Sharon Salzberg, she sort of stopped my mind when she was like, "Well, does it feel weak when someone loves you?" And I think that's so important. And but I also see how like I understand when you feel really powerless, when power is given to those who have money, for example, over those who don't, how resorting to violence or anger can seem very justifiable just to be able to be heard. How do you go about cultivating love in your life, and especially because you identify as an activist?
I think of love as it is a feeling. It is a feeling that's I think undeniable, but I think the most reliable path towards being in that process and that flow that is love is choosing action. I think that just like a meditation practice, it is something that one can put their mind on, choose to put their mind on, and put into action by physically doing things with your body and making choices about how to spend your time and your attention. And so, for me, I approach my practice of cultivating love in my life by really, really trying to have good attention. Attention is really huge for me. I'm a co-counselor, reevaluation counseling, which is an anti-oppression movement that relies heavily on the belief that human beings are completely good and born without prejudices and born without all of these trappings that gunk us up as we age and make us continue to enact the systems of empire on one another. And the idea is that we can actually heal from all of the ways that we get hurt and squashed into going along with those systems if we can just access our natural ability to heal, which is crying and shaking and laughing, sweating, those sorts of things. And that one of the best things that you can do to access that is to have the loving attention of another human being. That is a big piece of how I practice love in the world is by there's a lot of talk in organizing and activism circles about self-care and, slowing down and all of that stuff. And it's not something that we're great at. And we all have different skill sets, and some people are better at the spreadsheets, and some people are better at, the bullhorn in the street and that sort of thing. And what I've really cultivated is an ability to try and tend to the connections between organizers and the spiritual lives and the emotional lives of the people who are doing the work. And I count myself amongst those, but a lot of what I wind up doing is listening to folks and watching and noticing when they're not able to think well because they're not taking good enough care of themselves.
That's a really good way to put it. As I keep coming back to different questions that I can ask that can sort of interject when I encounter justifications for violence in any realm, where it's things like, how well do you think and process things when you're coming at it from a place of righteous indignation or rage versus when you come from a place of love? And I love like what you said, really. It's like saying love isn't just a feeling, it's also what you do. And it's how you do it. It's really action. So, and then that really speaks to nonviolent activism and nonviolent approaches to creating change, which leads me to you being a fellow for the Boggs Center in Detroit. For listeners who don't know, Grace Lee Boggs was a civil rights activist, and she never stopped being a civil rights activist. I think this is another thing that we sort of miss if we're not paying attention or we're not... you get very bombarded with information these days. And so I think that there's this sense that like the civil rights movement had sort of an end, and almost like that the end was with the assassination of Martin Luther King, and it wasn't. There's a lot of people who continued to do work and are still continuing to do that work. So Grace Lee Boggs is one of those examples. There is a fabulous interview on Being, as you well know, that I highly recommend to listeners. But could you tell us a bit about what you've learned and are no doubt continuing to learn from your work there, and what it has meant to you to be a fellow of the Boggs Center in Detroit, and what you've learned from that whole situation and setup and organization?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I'll say I am, the fellowship program is new, so I am newly a fellow. So we are in the process of figuring out exactly what being a fellow will mean and what it can mean and what we'd like to do with one another. So that is still unfolding. That said, this is kind of the newest iteration of my relationship with Grace's ideas and with the Boggs Center in Detroit. Essentially, what happened was I lived right up the street from the encampment in downtown Oakland during Occupy, during the Occupy movement, and was very moved by that uprising and got quite hopeful about actually seeing revolutionary change happen in my lifetime, and then was pretty crushed when things started to fall apart and things started to shift as the movement does, and kind of went seeking, and then I stumbled upon Grace Lee Boggs's I saw her on Democracy Now! Actually being interviewed by Amy Goodman, and I was like, who is this incredible elder who's been doing this work and it's speaking my mind? So I went and got her book, The Next American Revolution, which is highly recommended, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century. That's the subtitle. And I read that book and it blew my mind open as to, reframing what it meant that the Occupy movement had quote unquote fallen apart, and really just gave me a lot more, I think, a sense of hope because of changing my concept of what it takes to create revolutionary change, how long it takes, and the different faces that it has, the different phases of movement and that sort of thing. And so I knew I wanted to get to know her and her work better, and there happened to be a conference being planned that summer of 2012. Called the Detroit 2012 conference. So I figured out how to get out there, did a fundraising crowdsource campaign, and And went out there, and the conference was really incredible. It was a crash course in the activism in Detroit, the really local grassroots activism organized by the Boggs Center, and got to meet Grace and be in her home. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, incredible, incredible space where so many people have done movement work and had these important conversations throughout the years. And I think it's important to remember about Grace is that she was a philosopher, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She got her PhD in philosophy at Barnard as an Asian American woman, you know, at a time when that did not happen.
Yeah.
And she never gave that up. It was integral to her activism, and she really believed in ideas and the power of people having conversations with one another and the necessity of us grappling with these questions of what is a revolution? What are we after? What is the future we want to envision? And those sorts of things, and really challenging ourselves to co-create that together and really being clear about the fact that we're pretty impoverished in that area. We do know how to get out in the streets. And she was coming from a perspective of having done a lot of that. And, you know, she was an activist for, she lived to be 100. She was an activist for like 80 years.
Yeah.
So she went through many phases, and what she came to was that not only do we need to make the physical changes in the world, but we actually have to change ourselves,
yeah.
That we've internalized this capitalism and this racism and this sexism and homophobia and all of that, and that we have to do the hard work of having these conversations with one another and enlarging our imaginations so that we can even think up what we want instead, much less begin to make it. So that's a lot of what I've done with the Boggs Center, is engage in those types of dialogues and conversations and readings. They're really big on study and balancing that out with action in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so after that Detroit 2012 conference, I was part of a group of folks who call ourselves the Visionary Organizing Network, which Grace calls visionary organizing, this type of, you know, going beyond just action, but also going into study, looking at history and philosophy, and trying to envision what we want for our future. So we collectively put together a conference for 2013 and 2014 as well in Detroit, and then somewhat in 2015, but she was turning 100 that year. So that was a lot of what the activities were around. So,
yeah. Oh, that's really good. I totally appreciate that, actually. I find for myself as I study a lot, I always have. I've always had a really strong curiosity that I was fortunate enough to have parents really encourage and cultivate over time. And I've never looked at learning as something that's confined to a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, like, even just in the last few months and reading things, like listening to you talk about having the conversations and difficult conversations, and like also then from a Buddhist perspective, as somebody who spends a lot of time in meditation and doing various kinds of meditation, including looking at my own mind and looking at my thoughts and training myself and an awareness about how I react to things.
Mm.
And then I read a book like, say, Blind Spot, which is all about the IAT, the Implicit Association Tests, done
mm-hmm.
out of Harvard, and this is Mazarin Banerjee, and I cannot remember her co-author. I always forget his name. I'm so bad about it. Anyway, and that's the sort of thing, like, I read that book, and she's like going, here's scientific proof that it doesn't matter how egalitarian you are.
Yeah.
You are affected by the culture in which you were raised.
Right.
And then being armed with that information, going forward saying, right, I'm just going to be really genuine and upfront with myself that I'm going to make mistakes, and that getting woke is something you do every day, all the time, and that it's great to go out and do activism. But you're right. Like, what are you doing in your own
mm-hmm.
mind, in your own body, in your own sense? I love that that's something that she was really pushing out there, because I think, again, it's one of those things that you come across, but you kind of come across it within certain circles. Like, you see it a lot in Buddhism, obviously. But then making sure that it's really accessible, and philosophy, obviously, you know, philosophers are really big about doing some deep thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the importance of that. Could you talk a little bit about your role? Because I think you've described this quite well, that you see yourself in a position of being a facilitator of those conversations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And helping people connect with the need for self-care and what that looks like and reminding them of that. So could you talk a bit about when you've actually used that and what that looks like? Give like maybe a tangible example.
Yeah. So I would say self-care, but also other care, you know, like, part of self-care, I think, is also noticing your place in the community that you're working in, whether that's mm-hmm. just your office or, you know, a cohort of activists you're planning something with. So I would say both pieces of that is, you know, if we're enlarging the idea of where does the self end, or, you know, we talk a lot about at First Congo, my church, Jesus's body being made up, but, you know, the body of Christ being made up by all of us in the congregation. That's why we're lay-led. We all have to take a role in that. So so I think it's both of those things. And so thinking about the other people in your community, when you know you are, they make up part of what your body is, your larger body, your larger self, that is also a form of self-care. So a really recent example was some of the folks that go to my church just recently put together a conference called Arise in Power, and it was a national convergence of Christians and quote-unquote Jesus followers, because there are some folks like myself who don't identify as Christians, who are active in the movement for Black Lives, coming together to think about what it means to do quote-unquote liturgical direct action, which is, you know, the folks in my church a lot of times what we'll do. And there's a group called Second Acts, which is a Christian affinity group that organizes some of these events. And so that's doing direct action that is liturgically based, going out on Ash Wednesday tomorrow, and doing actions that, you know, reflect what we find in the stories of the Bible. So, so we were having a conference on that topic, and what I really found was that we were having some really, really deep conversations about difference. We were organizing across difference. There were Black folks, white folks, non-Black POC as well, people of color, and different people of different genders, sexual orientations, people of different faiths. And that was really huge for some people. Some people were like, whoa, there's non-Christians here, you know, because it was from all over the country. It wasn't just the crew that I'm used to out here, the radical Jesus followers in the Bay. So, and organizing across difference, if you're really, really doing it and you're providing enough safety in the way that you approach one another, real stuff is going to come up that's really, really hard. And that's some of what started to happen there, of course. And I did simple things like walking around to my friends who I knew were organizing it and giving them shoulder rubs and asking if I could listen to them. And they're used to me doing that, and they would just burst out crying, and scooping up white folks when I could tell they were falling into white guilt patterns and self-flagellation and that sort of thing, and listening to them, reminding them that they're loved, that this work is important, that they, you know, that they deserve forgiveness, that they get to do better, all of that. So really, I, you know, that was a lot of what I did at the conference, was actually like tending to my crew who had really put their neck out there and tried something really big and, you know, had to face the grief and the trauma and the really hard stuff that came up during that conference. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a conversation I've had with somebody that I interviewed earlier in the season as well, as just generally with people that I like in my social circle, about how being safe and being comfortable aren't the same thing. That you can have a safe space and it can get very uncomfortable, but that's the point. Like, you create a container of safety in order to have the uncomfortable conversations.
Yes.
And how to create that and then also maintain it when it happens, because it is something that can have a tipping point. And
it does.
I've been in those situations. I went to a queer youth camp in Edmonton years ago for the very first one, actually, when it first started, and now it's been going for years. And we spent 2 hours having a conversation about bathrooms. And there were 50 people, around 50 people in that room. And it got tense, but it never felt unsafe. Mm-hmm. And also understand, this was like, I'm saying this is years ago. This was like a decade ago. Mm. So when people were not having these conversations the way that they are now, and when issues around trans rights and access to bathrooms were still very much confined to queer communities and were not happening in the larger world. For me, it was a really good experience of watching the people who were facilitating what was going on in that room. And a lot of people complained that it went too long, but I understood why it went too long. Because the point was that we wanted to make sure everyone felt like they had the equal opportunity to be heard about what their needs were and their expectations. Mm-hmm. And then it was brilliant because in the end, we came up with a really fabulous solution, which was that we had one bathroom that you could book in to have completely privately to yourself. And then another bathroom that was a non-gendered, anybody could go anytime space. So it was like totally open bathroom space and then private bathroom space. There was a little sheet on the wall and you could sign up. There were no conflicts. Everyone was happy and felt really safe. But it was a hard conversation, right? Like it took 2 hours.
Yeah. And that's actually a pretty short conversation when you consider some of these things we're trying to take on. I mean, when you think about hundreds and thousands of years of oppressive forces, it's not a fast conversation, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, that was primarily, I think we're in a, when you're talking about context and who's there, right? The, mm-hmm. Like you said, the bigger the intersectionality, mm-hmm. the bigger the conversation becomes. Yep. And you can't ignore all the elements. You can't go, well, for the sake of expediency, we need to just ignore this. And you're like, well, that's been the whole problem.
And beside that point, you're not doing the work. You're not doing what you came there to do, mm-hmm. to actually have your vision opened to things that you had never noticed before, you know, and to have voices that get buried and covered up in the mainstream, you know, and the white gaze and such, you know, like you're not doing the work if you're not able to open more narratives up. So
yeah, and I mean that whole thing is understanding the intersectionality. Like there is no group that is solely oppressed and no group that is solely an oppressor. Like we all have elements of privilege and we all have elements of marginalization. Almost everybody basically mm-hmm. have some experience of both. Right. And learning how to, like you said, find that commonality, that common ground, and see that bigger, like when you're talking about the self-care and seeing how self-care is about community care. And I've started to really appreciate that as well, like sort of the longer view and seeing that when I have a very small sense of self, I suffer a lot more.
Yes.
When I have a much bigger sense of self, which is also to say when I'm coming from a place of love. And for me, this has also been a big transition, especially in the last few years. I no longer think of God in the concept of what I did when I was a kid, of like some sense of like big mythical person in the sky sitting on the clouds. But like, to me, I understand, like when I talk to people about God and their concept of God, or I listen to things about God, I hear God as love.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes. I think that's a great definition. I support it.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly it, right? Because that's when you say God is in you, we're not saying like some big white guy is a puppet master. We're saying actually love is in you. You are an agent of love.
Yes, yes. And you are in love. You are participating in a process that is about life and life-givingness and how to create more of that. And it's a process, not an object.
Totally. So let's talk about Standing Rock, if we mm-hmm. could. Standing mm-hmm. Rock, I mean, almost everybody probably has heard about that.
Yes. Yeah.
When did you go there?
It was crazy timing. We drove out on election day, so we were arriving on November 9th, 2016, that fateful day when we found out that 45 would be our next president. Mm.
So that's, yeah, that's some intense timing. Yeah. Could you talk a bit about, how do I want to put this? So I spend an awful lot of time being frustrated that I'm not doing enough. And you managed to have the wonderful opportunity of going there. Mm-hmm. It was pretty spontaneous, relatively spontaneous.
It was very spontaneous. You know, I'd been watching what was happening from the Bay and talking with my crew, my movement family out here. And I'm a birth doula for, you know, by trade. That's what I do to make my living. So I'm on call a lot. Mm-hmm. And I had this very short window between births of on-call periods where I could go. And I said, y'all, this is probably crazy, but what do you think? Are y'all available too? And we threw everything in motion, and we did a fundraiser. God love crowdfunding campaigns these days. They make so much possible for people by, again, you know, all pitching in together. But yeah, we were able to get out there. There was myself and three other women that are a part of my congregation went together, and then we met up with a crew of seven other people who were part of our spiritual community but not our church, who had gone separately. And we were there for a brief time. We went, you know, we have a lot of experience doing direct action here in the Bay Area. I mean, we've got a reputation for that, especially Oakland is a hotbed of, you know, lots of people chaining themselves to things. So, and we decided that it made sense to, there was a call at the time that they wanted bodies who were willing to go to the front lines and, put themselves in the, in between the construction and the police and militarized forces, because so many of their native folks who were there had been arrested so many times and they were needing some more support. So we thought we'd go. And we went very much thinking that we were going to be, you know, putting ourselves in harm's way and expecting to probably get arrested and all of that. And it was fascinating to see, again, the way that spirit works and how many different ways to affect change there are. Because it seemed pretty clear, even if it was hard for us to accept at first, that wasn't actually going to be our path. We got there a couple days before our friends who drove the entire way. We had flown partway and then drove the rest of the way due to our short time frame. And they had driven the entire way. And they had really different experiences than we did just because things were changing fast on the ground the whole time the camp was set up. And, you know, folks had different experiences. But it was interesting because I came with a crew of women who were you know, we're all big prayers, and we're all very accustomed to doing that with one another. But we also were in the streets a lot, and we thought that was what we were called to do. We thought we were going to go get arrested, and we kept trying to get arrested and not being successful on that front and being like, huh, okay, I guess we're going to pray instead. So it was a deeply humbling experience to see so many people live their faith so clearly and so boldly. Everything is done in a prayerful way out there. Everything. And everything takes a lot of work. Putting together a meal for thousands of people takes a lot of work with no running water in the cold. So we did a lot of dishes. We talked to people. We cooked food. We prayed a lot. We participated in water ceremonies. We did go to try and join up with actions that we thought would be arrestable and didn't turn out to be, and that sort of thing. And then on our final day, when we had to go back, and I had to go back to be on call, and Carol had to go preach the sermon that the following Sunday, when everybody was freaking out about Donald Trump being president, we were like, okay, if there's an opportunity to be arrested today, we're not going to do it because we already have tickets and we need to go home. And of course, that was the day when there was an opportunity. So our friends went and got arrested, and we went and supported them. And we drove the getaway van, and our sweet friends are still, there's five of them who are still working out the legal impacts of their having blocked a road. Basically, a crew of white folks, many of us people of faith, were asked to, or at least white presenting folks, because not everyone who came was white, were asked to block a street so that we could help delay the forces getting to some of the native folks who were doing another action. So we were successful in doing that. We blocked it, but then my crew left when the final dispersal order was given, and we drove the getaway van, and then have been helping to fundraise and emotionally support and continue to pray for one another as we've come back and as our friends are facing having to go back and face the legal system out there. So lots of roles in the movement, lots and lots of roles.
Lots of roles. And I guess that's the thing. So my final question for you then is, what sort of support or advice or information would you offer to people who are listening who want to make a difference, who can't necessarily spontaneously go somewhere like Standing Rock, but want to be able to do something either at a local level for a greater global benefit or at a global level?
Notice what it is that you love and that you're good at, and then give that to the movements that touch your heart. And you might find that you'll learn new things will excite you and touch you and make you want to develop skills. But we need cooks. We need masseuses. We need people who listen. We need people who really love and feel liberated by chaining themselves to things and saying, no way, this machine is not moving forward. We need people who do spreadsheets. We need all of that in the movement. So know what that is for you and offer it. And go local. Go to your crew. I mean, I feel like a lot of what I do and what I'm most proud of in my organizing life is building, you know, as Dr. King talked about, building that beloved community, you know, that movement work does not become some special thing that happens when there's something, you know, of high political import, like the election of Donald Trump happening, but it's a way of life. It's just the way that you live together. And it's about caring for yourself, which is caring for your community, which is caring for the greater earth. And, you know, watching the way that all those things are interconnected. So making relationships, I think, is absolutely key. And we have to grow these movements right now because this is a very this is a very late hot date on the climate calendar, as I like to say. You know, we actually do have a deadline we're working against here. We need to have radical shifts in our priorities and everything from how we're set up economically to, you know, how what our concept of work is or how we live together in terms of housing, those sorts of things, has to have a radical shift in the next 5 to 15 years to save life on this planet. And we're blessed to be alive during this time, and you can let that scare you to death. Hopefully you won't do that for too long. Because we have to do this together. And so I think the main thing is we have to make those relationships that are going to be really tight and really strong and that actually make us irresistibly attractive to other people who are not involved in quote-unquote movement work.
Thank you so much for listening. You can visit firstoakland.org to find out more about the church Michelle attends and how you can help support the work that they do. You can visit bogscenter.org, that's B-O-G-G-S, center, spelled the American way with an E-R on the end, .org, to find out about the legacy and work of Grace Lee Boggs. To find out more about what I do, visit caitlinschatch.com, where you can sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email, read my blog, check out my artwork, and leave a tip to help support my work in the world. Thank you as well to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable.